This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who have done remarkable things for the sake of our freedom, and we don't want to take that for granted. The goal of this show is to, first of all, honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we understand and we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we're educated, we're entertained, and even inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I tell you, I'm pretty excited about our next episode. A 93-year-old who was a Marine on Guadalcanal, became an aerial gunner, then a decorated pilot with some close calls that you're going to have a hard time believing. But that's next time. And for today, you know, some of the most compelling stories we've heard on Hometown Heroes over the years have been from ex-prisoners of war. If anybody understands the value of freedom, it's those people who have been forced to live in captivity. And over the years, I've had the privilege of sitting down with ex-POWs all over the country, Arizona, Pennsylvania, Nevada, Texas, Washington, New Mexico, all over California, you name it. And I thought, since this week marked National POW MIA Recognition Day, that's the third Friday of September every year, I thought it would make sense to hear from some ex-POWs today. We're going to hear from three different men who not only were taken prisoner, they all had to survive death marches. Two of them on the infamous Bataan Death March in the Philippines, the other on a march that isn't as well known but was certainly harrowing, the German Death March across Europe. They come from different backgrounds. One grew up not far from our southern border in New Mexico, another a Native American raised by his aunt in Kentucky, and the third a minister's son from California's Central Coast. We'll get just a taste of the kinds of things they endured, and if you're anything like me, by the time we're done, you're going to feel like some of the challenges you're facing pale in comparison with what they went through during World War II. We'll start with one of the first veterans to ever appear on Hometown Heroes way back in 2007. Wild Bill Begley is his name. Yeah, that's his real name, Wild Bill. And if you ever go to a ceremony at the VA in Fresno, you'll probably see him there in his wheelchair wearing his distinctive hat. He can't communicate as well as he used to, but if you see him salute the flag with that sincerity he has, it might make your eyes water like his do. Let's jump into his interview where he remembers arriving at Clark Field in the Philippines in November 1941 with the 34th Pursuit Squadron. He was a radar and radio operator, and he was expecting to find P-40 Warhawks to work with.
It was quite a shock when he got there. They just took us out in a field, and they said, "Here, this is what we got." They were worn-out P-35s that were originally slated to go to Sweden, and the Philippine Air Force had wore them out, and grass had gone up through the canopies and all through it and outside. That's what we got.
So you looked around thinking this was some kind of sick joke or something.
Yeah, well, they gave us 25 of them, and naturally they weren't flyable. But we had some good mechanics, and we cannibalized five of them. We got all of them going. And the next shock was, "Where's our airfield?" They took us out sugarcane field and says, "Here, cut the sugarcane." Well, we did. And then somebody says, "There's some tankers out there. I think there's molasses." Somebody said, "Well, let's try it on the runway because the dust was so thick." So they poured sugarcane molasses on the dust so they could see when they landed.
You'd been there less than 3 weeks when that date we all remember as December 7th, 1941 rolled around. But for you, it was December 8th because you were on the other side of the international dateline. The Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Word comes to you guys over the radio. You have these planes ready to go thanks to your mechanics, maybe a little underarmed with just two 30 caliber machine guns on each plane. But General MacArthur issued an order to ground all planes. And your pilots did not follow that order, did they?
Our squadron commander took it to heart, and he explained it to the 20 pilots that we had. And he said, "Look, man, I'm not going to sit on my butt and get what we have shot up. I'm going to take off. I'm not going to tell you to go because you'd be subject to court-martial." So he took off. He says, I'll do what I can to keep you out of trouble. They all took off. And then lo and behold, up above us, just as they were taking off, about 60 Japanese bombers and fighters appeared right over the airdrome. But they took off anyhow. And it's a wonder they hadn't dropped down and got them. But they made it clear. I could hear the squadron commander say, "Look, men, we'll stay together in the group. If you get a good shot, take it. One of them gets on the other's tail, take him if you can." And that was it. The upshot of it was there's a lot of shooting and air acrobatics and up there, and when they landed, all of them were shot up pretty bad. We didn't lose any, but they shot down two Japanese planes, and the ground crew got two more, and then we looked out. We could see at least two more on fire. So they did a pretty good job. We didn't lose a single plane, although they were badly shot up.
And I can tell even now that the courage those pilots displayed still means something to you. They know they're facing court-martial just for taking off. Not only do they take off, they're outnumbered 3-1. Their planes aren't as fast or have as much firepower as the Japanese, yet all of them land and take out four Japanese planes in the process. So obviously a lot of courage on display that day. But you yourself would have to summon quite a lot of courage before the war was over. Not long after that, your supplies started to run out. The Americans were outnumbered on the Bataan Peninsula. And when they didn't have enough gas to fly the planes anymore, they gave you a bit of a surprise when they said, "You're in the infantry now." Had you had any kind of infantry training?
Believe it or not, I didn't. For basic training, I had practically nothing except the Articles of War and march and march and march. The thing about it is the only arm that I saw was on the hip of an MP somewhere. And the pitiful thing about it, after we became infantry, they issued us one bandolier shell and said, don't shoot any of these unless you have to. Later on, our adjutant, a young lieutenant, said, "All right, line up." And we were about 50 feet apart. And he says, "Look, men, don't shoot until you see the whites of their eyes." And the shooting match started. The bad thing about it, all the rifles and stuff that we got were condemned. And I had, with the one I got, I'd pick it up and the bolt would flop. I put another one in there, and during the firing, it froze. And it was a bad situation. I couldn't fire it, and I couldn't eject the shell. But after it cooled, I made sure I fired slow.
I suppose so, if it's all rejected rifles from World War I that they've got you using out there, not to mention no infantry training, not to mention you're outnumbered, you didn't have any food. Can you give us an idea of the kinds of things that you had to resort to eating?
Well, we had a saying, if it moves, eat it. If it stands still, we salute it. We ate monkeys and snakes big, ugly lizards. Anything that walked, crawled, or flew, we ate. That was about it. The thing about it is we were starving, actually. We ran out of food, and right at the last, whenever General MacArthur sent word by General King for us to surrender, we didn't want to, none of us did, but that was the orders of the day. And we stacked up our rifles and went out to the road, and there's where the real terrible things happen.
That may be an understatement. When Bataan fell, the surrender of 78,000 American and Filipino troops to the Japanese was just the beginning of what was going to be 3.5 years of captivity for you. And I'm sure you had no idea how much you're going to have to go through, how much you'd have to survive. But do you remember what was going through your mind when you became a prisoner of war?
I was already in bad shape. As I said, I went from 180 pounds to about 110 approximately. And the reason is we didn't have any food. And like I said, if it moved, eat it. If it stood still, we always said salute it.
But once you're on the march, you don't even have the opportunity to do that. If you stop even to try to get a drink of water, you might get shot, bayoneted, even decapitated. You witnessed all of those things happen, didn't you?
Yes, unfortunately, I witnessed all of that kind of stuff. I walked approximately about 100 miles, I suppose. It was a terrible ordeal because they didn't give us any rest. We couldn't get any water. I went on the march. I was on it about 10 days, approximately, and I didn't get any food, didn't get any water. Guys would drop out, and they'd try to help one another, and it was pitiful. If you stopped, they'd either shoot or bayonet you. They got so they seemed to enjoy bayoneting more than anything else. It was terrible. The thing about it is they also got some women and children, unfortunately, and they wouldn't let them out. They finally did. Quite a few of the Philippine soldiers, they slept off into the forest, and if they got caught, they'd get shot. Or bayoneted. So you had to be careful. The thing about it is they didn't have a whole bunch of guards there, but they had enough to where they could see from one guard to the other. We stopped at one place. I think it was the town of San Fernando, and they lectured us in Japanese. They had an interpreter that would tell us what he's saying. And they said you'd be shot and you'd be bayoneted. You had to do what they wanted to. And if you dared to get off the road, see a dirty ditch full of filthy water, a lot of guys would be desperate and they'd make a break for it. And they'd shoot them and bayonet them. You couldn't even get at that. It was pretty horrible. Later, when we made a stop, there's a bunch of Japanese officers were drinking and enjoying themselves, and they taunt us, and we did get to sit down. And every now and then they'd pick out 10 men, make them dig a hole in the ground, and they would use their two-handed samurai sword, and they tried to first see if they could decapitate a guy with one lick. They'd make it come to attention, and they'd walk away. Mm. Then later, they got tired of that because they got blood all over their uniforms and their equipment, so they decided to change it, and they lined us up about 10 again. You dig a hole, then they'd come around behind and shoot you in the back of the head. You'd fall in.
Mm.
That went on until they got tired, and then they had us take off. We walked day and night, no food, no water. It's a terrible ordeal. I remember in particular two incidents that still come to mind. There's a lady. We went through a little barrio, they call that a town. She had a little boy about 3 years old. He stuck his finger up and said, V for victory. When he did, a Japanese guard happened to be close by, and he bayoneted the little fella. Mm. And he raised him up, and he tried to fling him off his bayonet, and his mother screamed. She ran out there, and she tried to cover him, and the guard bayoneted her, and she died right there. And one other particular incident that was kind of bad was two chaplains were going across the bridge along with the rest of us, and one of them decided, well, this is too much, and he jumped. And the other chaplain ran around and tried to get to him. And when he did, the guard motioned him back and didn't want to get to him, but he insisted. So he shot him, and then he bayoneted him. They died holding hands.
Hmm.
Unbelievable things that you witnessed, and I know some that you experienced yourself. You estimated you were bayoneted 30 different times, and after the march was over, you were still a prisoner of war another 3.5 years before you were liberated, wasting away to 68 pounds. That's less than 40% of your original weight. That is almost unfathomable. I'm sure there were days there where you thought you were going to die. So what kept you going? What allowed you to believe that you could survive and come back and get married and have a family and have the kind of life that you were fighting to preserve?
I didn't have no fancy thoughts about marrying or anything like that. I was worried whether or not I'd ever get through and survive. That was the main consideration. And under the circumstances, you wonder what made me keep going and whatnot. Well, later on, we got into some barracks and whatnot. I seen guys actually more or less commit suicide because they couldn't take it. And what they do, they just turn the face to the wall. By then, they were giving us a bowl of watery rice once a day and get one canteen of water until they picked us up and sent us by ship to Mukden, Manchuria. There we got a little better consideration because they put us in, most of us, in the tool and die factory where they made the tools for machinery or plane parts or anything. Everybody, 100% of us, sabotaged everything. And they had guards right over us, and we'd put filings in the oil and all kinds of stuff. Some of the guys were really innovative, and they would figure out some real sly ways of saboteuring the parts that we would make. And when they get a part made, it wouldn't fit. No way.
You spent a long time in Squaw Valley and more recently in Fresno, but I know one thing that you've done is traveled all over the state to serve on an honor guard participating in military funerals. Why was it so important for you to do that?
Well, when we got to O'Donnell, the first prisoner of war camp, the guys were dying so fast, and it was terrible. And they're in bad shape. The ones that were standing and able to walk and carry somebody, we'd get a door off of a hut, and four of us get on it many times before we got to the hole in the ground where we'd have to throw them in there. Maybe half of the guys, and I've seen as many as four of the stretcher bearers, would die en route. It was pretty tough.
What an understatement. That is Wild Bill Begley, an interview recorded 7 years ago now. Time for a break, but when we come back, again, commemorating National POW MIA Recognition Day, we're going to hear from another survivor of the Bataan Death March, Hometown Heroes, right back after this.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, honoring National POW MIA Day by listening to three different ex-prisoners of war. We heard from Bataan Death March survivor Wild Bill Begley. Now we turn to Julio Barella, a man I had the privilege of interviewing in Truth or Consequences, New Mexico in 2010. By the way, there were more men from New Mexico on the Bataan Death March than from any other state. If you go to Las Cruces, the only federally funded memorial to the Bataan Death March is a beautiful sight in a park there. It has a statue of two men helping another, and in front and behind it, footsteps in the concrete. Some are shoes, some are bare feet, and those bare footprints are the actual footprints of men who survived the Bataan Death March. It's a must-see if you ever end up in the Las Cruces, El Paso area. As for Julio, at the age of 16, he had left his family farm north of Las Cruces to go to California and enlist in the Navy, Problem was, Mama was not so happy about that. His mother went out there, told him that he was underage, and then brought him back to the farm. But in May of 1941, there was nothing she could do about it. Julio was 22 then, and he was drafted into the Army.
We were supposed to serve 1 year. And then when we got there, they increased to 18 months. And after the 18 months, it was for all the duration of war. I spent in the Philippines and Japan almost 5.5 years.
Right, because you were there in the Philippines before the war started. And, of course, you weren't liberated in Japan till after the war ended. I read that all your equipment hadn't even been unpacked when the Japanese attacked. And I understand whatever equipment and supplies you did have wasn't anywhere near what you needed.
And we didn't have enough to fight with to begin with. So we did what we could until we ran out of everything. We ran out of food, too, so we ran out of ammunition. We didn't have any ammunition to fight, so we were forced to surrender. That was in Bataan.
And that was in April of 1942, 5 months after the war had started. And I'd like for you to shed a little light on those 5 months between being attacked at Clark Field and when the march started. Now, the unit you were with, everybody from New Mexico, and you were chosen especially because so many of you spoke Spanish, which they thought might come in handy in the Philippines. That was the 200th Coast Artillery, right?
200th Coast Artillery.
What kind of things were you expected to do? What were your duties?
Well, it was a 3-inch gun and 5-inch gun. And we had searchlights, power plants. We buried the power plant in order to get electricity to run the control stations.
But an artillery unit isn't much good when you run out of ammunition, huh?
Well, we run out of everything. We didn't have any way of fighting.
When you heard that you guys were being surrendered to the Japanese, what went through your mind? How did that make you feel, and what were you thinking?
The reason was this. They still called us the Death March. Well, they named the Death March, the Japanese named the Death March, because, you know, we didn't surrender when we were told. We were told at the very beginning of the war to surrender, and we didn't surrender. We tried to fight them. So we didn't surrender until we ran out of everything. We were starving, eating weeds and stuff like that in order to survive. And there's where the death march started.
Now, when you started that march, you had no idea how long it was going to go, and you're already starving, right?
We were pretty weak then because when we were fighting, we didn't have enough to eat. First thing, we were getting only 2 meals a day, and then they cut us to 1 meal a day. And then after that, we didn't have anything to eat.
What kept you going? How did you continue on? Because I'm sure a lot of guys were falling by the side and probably getting shot or bayoneted, and you were seeing guys fall left and right. What kept you going? How do you think you survived?
Well, we used to hunt. We used to eat weeds and stuff like that. Then a lot of them died with malaria, and a lot of them with diarrhea, according to what they eat. See, a lot of them died in the death march. And then the other part died in concentration camp.
Did you ever think that you were going to die?
I thought I was going to die, but I just got to where I didn't care. I used to worry a lot about my folks, about my mother. I used to worry every day. And one day I said to myself, "Why hell, I'm nothing but a doggone stupid. I'm not going to worry about them because they're better off than I am. They're not having it as much trouble as I am." We got to where we forgot all about our folks and about the living life. Maybe we were just lucky because when they surrendered, a lot of them died of starvation. A lot of them, they didn't have anything to eat. They were weak, malaria, dysentery, and all that, a lot of disease. Well, we got to where we didn't care. We used to help the ones that couldn't walk. By the Japanese, the ones that couldn't walk, they shoot them. When a man lay down and he can't get up, why, they shoot him. So if they were punish you when you were in concentration camp, they punished me and they knocked me down. And then I have in mind But if I try to stand up and get up, I won't be killed. That's a lesson the hard way.
I'll say that's a great way to put it, learning the hard way indeed. And every survivor of the Death March that I've interviewed over the years has told me really the same thing that you just did. No one knows exactly how many people died on the march. I've seen estimates of around 10,000 or so. And who knows how many died later because of what they went through on the march. But I know that you Americans helped each other, and you got a lot of help from the Filipinos, who, from what I've seen statistically, outnumbered Americans on the march about 7-1. But all of you were not only marching 61 miles through deep layers of dust, you really didn't have any kind of nourishment. How bad was it? How bad in terms of what you had to eat and drink?
They make us wait 3 days before they could start giving us a bowl of rice, just how much they can grab on a bowl of rice. Then in concentration camps, we were there starving all the time that we were in prison camp. We never did get anything much to eat, and they were Filipinos. They would try to help us, give us food. They find out that Filipino tried to help POWs. They would shoot them, burn their kids, burn their homes. They act like they were not civilized. We never have a dream that we was going to survive. We never thought we was going to make it.
Do you remember how much you weighed before?
I weighed about 145, 150. I never been very heavy. But when I was liberated, I weighed 83 pounds.
Skin and bones, huh?
Yeah.
And in addition to starving to death, you really had to live in constant fear of death. I really don't want to fan any kind of flames of anger or resentment or anything like that. But I want to understand, and I think our listeners want to understand, you weren't just starving to death. You had reason to believe that you could be shot, you could be bayoneted, beheaded even, for something that not even that you did, but that one of your fellow prisoners did.
Oh, I tell you this, but you probably won't believe.
I'll believe you.
But you know, a lot of the prisoners of war tried to escape, and that escaped made the Japs decide to divide the group in tens. So if one of the 10 survive, the other dying, they will kill them. And they kill a lot of Americans. People don't believe. Just the only people that believe, the people that saw that, the Filipinos. The Filipinos, they know that. They did that. They line them up and they shoot down. I saw them with my eyes.
So they would execute the other 9 prisoners in a group of 10 because of the one who tried to escape. I know it was truly a horrific experience, and I know it's not easy for you to talk about. So let's move on to a more pleasant topic, if you will. Your liberation. You survived the march to Camp O'Donnell. You'd been in another infamous camp at Cabanatuan. They took you over to Japan on a hell ship, and in late August of 1945, the atomic bombs had been dropped, the war was coming to an end, and finally, your camp at Niigata, Japan, was liberated. What do you remember about that? What do you remember about tasting freedom again for the first time in more than 3.5 years?
We're very, very weak. Our mind was very weak, and our bodies very weak. We couldn't hardly do much work. We just hope and pray that someday the war will be over. We were working in a foundry. They never gave us a day off, so we noticed that it was a surprise to us that the Japanese said that we were going to get 3 days off, that we have to stay in camp. So we were anxious to hear the Japanese commander telling us that we have surrendered. And the American officer asked the Japanese, what happened? Nothing. You people won the war. The war is over. Now you people take over tonight. What the Japanese told the American commander, you take care of your prisoners, not to go out because they're going to get killed, because the Japanese don't like the American prisoners, and they're going to get killed if they go out of the camp. So better stay in the camp, so we stay there, you know, until the next day. Then the next day, they go three planes, and they drop us leaflets. saying that if we would clear the area, they will drop packages.
So they dropped some leaflets. They said, get out of the way. We don't want to kill you with the food we want to drop for you. And then you finally got to go outside of the walls of that camp. You'd been living in the, I would imagine, and you have described what would be a bleak, seemingly hopeless world for so long, only praying that you'd make it out alive. So not to be too cliched, but did it feel like a dream come true or a prayer answered when you got to come home? What did that feel like?
Well, we had plenty to eat. Every place we go, we just give us something to eat and stuff like that. And it was pretty hard to tell the whole story about it. And I don't know, and some people, well, the prisoners of war I have talked to, they feel the same way that I feel. They didn't want to talk about it. They got to where they didn't want to talk about it. That's funny. We do more talking now than we did before. We never did say anything because everywhere we go, we start asking us, do you have any Japanese that we killed and all that? None.
How often do you think about the other prisoners of war who didn't get to come home? Do you ever think about that, about all the guys who died over there?
I dream more about them than I dream about my people, even today. Every day I remember about some of the prisoners.
Do you ever think that could have been you? Do you ever think about the, you know, how you could have died there?
Yeah, surprises me that I made it. I sometimes don't even believe it. Being so long and I've getting old and all that, I sometimes don't believe it. I made it. I don't believe it. I went through all that.
Why do you think it's important that people understand what happened to you and what happened to all those other prisoners?
It's something that I haven't seen before, and I don't think they'll ever see that again. For some people, it's unbelievable. This is what I have in mind. I hope the people, the modern people, will know what Japan did. Keep that in mind, what the Germans did. Keep that in mind.
I guess when you take everything into consideration, you'd have to say you beat some pretty significant odds to be sitting with me right now and talking about it.
Very few prisoners came back. A number died after they arrived in the United States. They were not in good health, and they died. But I guess I was lucky.
Wow. You gaining some perspective today? He said he was lucky, but how fortunate are we that we haven't been through anything like what you've heard now from two different survivors of the Bataan Death March. When we come back, we're going to hear about a different march that took place later in the war in different conditions. The rest of Hometown Heroes right after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Three stories for the price of one today as we mark National POW MIA Recognition Day. We've imagined walking in the footsteps of two men who survived the infamous Bataan Death March. For Wild Bill Begley and Julio Barella, that march came at the beginning of their captivity. But for men who endured the German Death March in the brutal winter of 1945, It came after they had spent months in prisoner of war camps. One of those men who trudged more than 500 miles through the snow with barely anything to eat is Carl Heuser of Cayucas, California. He grew up in Paso Robles, the son of a Lutheran minister. In August of 1942, he enlisted in the Army Air Corps and made it through some pilot training before being rerouted to gunnery school. And he ended up flying, as he says it, 10 and a half missions as a gunner on A-20 Havocs. At hometownheroesradio.com, you can see a photo of his A-20 when he was shot down. The reason he says 10 and a half missions, he was shot down on his 11th mission.
You could see and smell the bursting of the anti-aircraft shells. And you could smell it, but you just kept right on flying. The German anti-aircraft was very accurate at our level. We were only about 10 or 11,000 feet, and very accurate there. And we lost a lot of planes because of that. But because we had to fly that level so that our bombing was more accurate. And we were bombing bridges and railroads and things like this, and troops. But when we got rid of those bombs, we turned around and go, oh, yeah. I mean, we went home in a hurry. It was always across the channel. There was nothing ahead of time to warn us. It just, we knew that there was, you could see them, and you'd fly right through them. The bursts of the black smoke, you'd fly right through it. But sooner or later, there would be one for you. And sure enough, it just picked us right out of the center of the squadron, just took the whole tail off of our airplane. And like I said, the gunner down with Fred, who was down below, he had his camera. And the camera was just blown out of his head, but that's what kept him from getting killed. Otherwise, that blast would have killed him. His flak suit looked like somebody had taken a shotgun about 5 feet away and just shot at him. I was in pretty good shape when I got there. I was not wounded, but like I said, I spent as little time as I could in the air. But the Germans were there waiting for me when I came down. They were right there on the ground. The same people that shot us down, by the way. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, they were pretty proud of us. They marched us into town. They let us keep our shoes on, but they took all the rest of our paraphernalia off, all the military stuff, and took that off. This is kind of funny. They put us into the basement of a home and took all of our clothes off. Everybody took us stark naked, and then they marched us upstairs to stand in front of this officer's desk. He's going to interrogate us. And here I'm standing there stark naked, and this guy's playing with my .45, my gun. And I knew it was loaded. I had a shell in the chamber. And I'm telling him, you stupid so-and-so, that gun is loaded. You better let me take care of it. And the guards are poking me in the back with their rifles. The adrenaline was really flowing because I didn't have any fear at all about hurting him, but I had to tell him. So he finally handed me my .45 and let me take it apart. I took all the shells out and put it back on the desk. But that was a funny thing.
What was going through your mind as you floated down to the ground, got captured, get taken to be interrogated, all that? I mean, I'm sure you never expected to be in that situation. So what was it like when you were? Were you just kind of shocked? What were you feeling?
You thought about what you did when certain things would happen. You always had to sort of presuppose things and so on. But I had never thought about what would happen if I got shot down. I was not going to get shot down. So there it comes, and I'm doing it. And I can only remember very vaguely the thoughts that went through my head. I said, damn it, the war's over for you. You're not going home after any 65 missions. Then, of course, I could also say that I was glad to be alive. I got a good story to tell you. In prison camp, in our camp, we were all in bed. There was a lot, just oodles of us. There were over 8,000 of us in Solid Glove 4. And we'd go out and have a parade every day. Every morning I had a parade. As soon as we'd get up, they'd count us. The Germans could only count by fives, so we had to line up by fives. So they had given us a parcel when we got further. It had a sweater in it and some shorts and socks and toothpaste and so on. And anyhow, I had a box of a can of brown shoe polish. I wonder why they wanted us to shoe polish. And now, we had a guy in our room, his name was Beatty. And Beatty came from Tonawanda, New York. And he was always telling stories. He was funnier than hell. Anyhow, he went around to everybody and convinced them all to paint a brown Hitler mustache with that shoe polish. And our whole barracks did that. Well, we fell out as usual. And the German guard did not know how to handle this. They run back and forth. Usually this would take about 5 or 10 minutes. It would take us 20 minutes. They said, stay right here. And then they went, the commandant, our commandant came in. And he said, what's the matter? And he laughed. Anyhow, they said, go back to your barracks. So the German guards then went to the barracks, and they convinced the commandant, the German commandant. We had heard good feelings about him. He had been an ME-109 pilot shot down in Africa and been sent to America for medical treatment, and he was back again. He was a tall guy, very imposing. I mean, he was a real typical, if you want to say a typical German officer, this was him. So he came in, and here we're lined up again, all with our mustaches. And I still think I saw a smile on his face. But he's told you. But anyhow, they chatted for about 5 or 10 minutes. Okay, everybody back there, but no more facial paintings. No more face paintings. Okay, so we won't paint any more Hitler mustaches on. That was funny. We had to make our own fun.
Well, yeah, you had to make your own a lot of things, from what I understand, from all the POWs I've interviewed. How difficult was it to be in those conditions, whether it was the weather, the lack of proper food, the uncertainty of the whole thing, not knowing when you're ever going to get out of there? How did you deal with all of that?
Everybody had their own feelings about what was going to happen to them. We didn't know, we didn't have any idea how the Germans were going to treat us or mistreat us. We were all apprehensive. We thought, well, you know, they could mistreat us, but they did not mistreat us. The only thing they didn't do, they didn't feed us, but they did not mistreat us.
No, and you were there for a while, all the way until February 1945, when they marched you out of there to avoid the incoming Russians.
We were the last people to get out, I think, really. And it was snow. It was one of the worst winters they'd had back there. And we took our blankets, so that's all we had. Sleep three together. And I had had a blood poisoning on my foot. I stepped on a piece of glass, and I got an infection in my foot. And that foot was still... It was healing because the doctor had healed it up, and it was still warm from fever. And everybody put their feet, all their feet against my one foot to keep their feet warm when we sleep. We slept on the snow many times at night, and you did a lot of rolling around. You didn't sleep an awful lot, but then the next morning you get up and you get going again. The Germans had dogs that they had with them pretty quick. Their dogs were all of our good friends. We could pet them and stuff. That marched us almost 3 months, 88 days we marched. We would go from town to town. Some days we'd march 30 kilometers, some days we'd march 5 kilometers. They just did not know what to do with us except to keep us away from the Russians. That was their main, because they were scared stiff of the Russians for good reason. You know, the Russians were entirely different kind of soldiers than the Germans were. As I said, the Germans did not abuse us. They just didn't feed us.
Let's expound on that for a minute if you can, because some people who've heard this show and heard other POWs might have an idea of what that was like. But let me just ask you a few questions. How much do you think you weighed when you were captured?
My regular weight at that time was about 145 pounds. And I know my belt was, I could tell, not my belt, probably weighed about 90 pounds when I was liberated. We lost a lot of weight.
Well, and for you, a lot of that was due to the march too, but just in the camp itself, I'm sure you started losing weight. What all did they feed you? Are we talking about the infamous bread you need a power saw to cut through, or what were you eating?
The German rations in camp with a bucket full of potatoes per room, and they had to be scraped, not peeled. They had to be scraped, and then they would go back and cook them, and then get them back in for lunch. And a bucket full of potatoes and a piece of, like, pumpernickel bread, about maybe an inch and a quarter thick, and a pat of butter on top of that. And that was the German ration. That's what the Germans gave us. We had Red Cross parcels, and they would dole them out to us as they wanted to. But that was what I saved it, because we would get, every day we'd get a different can. You had to turn in. If you turned in 20 cans, if you got 20 cans, you had to turn in 20 cans, so you couldn't keep any cans. So, but every day was a little bit something different. Red Cross parcels were very, very helpful. That's why some people don't like the Red Cross too much, but they were the people that got that stuff to us. So, I remember I wrote a letter to Ann Landers, because she had taken on the Red Cross for some reason. I said, don't forget what they did for us. They were the ones that got it to us. That was important. I think very few of the guys in our camp got any mail back. That was hard. Now, remember, it was August the 4th when I was shot down. Excuse me. My parents probably had a letter or two after that, but they did not know what happened to me until January. I was there. I wasn't even thinking about that. But when I got home, I thought, boy, that was a long time not to know anything. I've still got the cables from the government.
And I want to understand what life was like in that camp. And like you said, everyone had a little different perspective there. But when you look back at the time you spent in captivity, do you see something that helped you get through that? Was there something about your mindset, your faith, your confidence? How did you survive all that in the face of so many things that would make people want to give up?
We supported each other. I think that's the prime feature of this. When we saw a guy starting to get a little bit, you know, he's on his way, we would gather up together and take care of him. We'd walk with him. We would give him extra, some of our food, if necessary. But anyhow, we were going to make damn sure that nobody in our care went off the deep end. And I think we all knew that we were going to win the war. We knew we were going to, it doesn't matter when. We all knew that we just had to do what we had to do to stay alive, to stay there. Like I said, it was just making sure that nothing happened to me, because nothing's going to happen to you. Our camp was up in Poland, and the Russians were coming close. The Russians were coming from the east towards the west, and the Germans had no right, no use at all for the Russians. They were scared stiff of the Russians. And so they, as I said, they marched us out 1,000 a day, and we were one of the last groups that went out there, but they gave us a parcel of food to take with us, and we had our blankets and so forth, and we just had to go as we went. And like I said, it was the first part of February, and this is one of the worst winters that they had had in Northern Europe. And it was a bitter winter, bitter cold. And three of us would gather together, and we would just hug each other to try to stay warm at night. As we went on and the weather got better, then we began to read each other's shirt sleeves and so forth for lice. We had lice, and we had the same clothes on for 3 months. We didn't change anything. A lot of us had dysentery, and our pants were dirty, and we couldn't do a thing about it. We had to keep on going.
I don't know if people can really fathom marching for that long and for that many miles. I'm sure there were guys that were getting weak and couldn't keep up. What happened to someone who just couldn't keep going?
Occasionally, and this only happened, I would say, 12, 15 times. If a guy had to fall out of the formation, a guard had to go with him. And very often, you'd hear a one shot, and the guard would come back alone. But because the guy he couldn't make it anymore, the guard knew it, he knew it, and they'd just leave him there.
Were there ever moments where you wondered if you could keep going, where you thought you were about at your last ounce of strength?
No. And the reason is my faith in God. I prayed. In fact, I was the leader of our little group, and I would pray. When we'd get started, and we'd always have a prayer, and we'd wind up with the Lord's Prayer. And I never did even think that I wasn't going to make it because of my faith in God. And I knew He was going to take care of me.
Well, and obviously He did, and I think everyone listening appreciates how powerful that reality is for you, especially looking back now. I don't want to dwell on this too long, but just so we understand how brutal this march was.
The cold, for one thing. You told me that you would come to a farmhouse and see a big old pile of manure, stinky manure, and stick your feet in the pile of manure because you knew it was warm?
And we could also do the same thing with food. Put it in there to get it warm if we had it, and you'd pull it out and you'd eat it. I mean, it didn't matter that it had been in a pile of manure. It was something to eat, and food was so, there was nothing, absolutely nothing thrown away. It was just, you'd eat everything you could and then some.
Could you tell when you were getting toward the end of that march, did you sense freedom beckoning? What do you remember about those last moments of the march and how great it felt to be free again?
The guards were getting closer and closer to us. They were telling us their names. And they knew they were going to be prisoners also. So they were telling us their name and this in a way, you know, please take care of me. We just marched them into an area. They threw their guns on a pile and marched them into an area and marched us around them. And that was the end of it. And then we went to a bridge. This is at Elberfeld. Went to a bridge, and half of the bridge had been bombed. We went on pylons. An American Jeep. A soldier in a Jeep. And he's handing us cigarettes. And we cried. It was a moment of freedom. We just stood there and cried. Grown men, I'll never forget that.
And you talked about being 145 pounds and down to under 100 pounds, wasting away. And I imagine there was a little bit of food for you once you were free again, too. Did you take it easy, or did you go a little too fast?
This is another most funny thing. We found a U.S. A truck that it was a kitchen truck. They were cooking food under and so forth. Thick pieces of fresh white bread. They just baked them. They baked them themselves. They gave us. They smeared butter on them for it, and they gave us marmalade, about that thick. And we ate it. And 5 minutes, I'd go over and puke it out, and we'd go back to the kitchen and do the same thing over again. Our stomach just couldn't handle it, and we'd just puke it out. Hunger's a terrible thing. That was the one thing that we were afraid of dying. Was by hunger. We weren't afraid of the Germans killing us or hurting us or the Russians. We were afraid we would die of hunger because we didn't have anything to eat. And we would go, I remember the week before Easter that year, 45, we went a whole week without anything, not a thing to eat.
Was it emotional to see your parents again?
More emotional for them than for me. My mother just hugged me and cried. And I wasn't crying. I was just glad to be there. But she was crying. And she was hugging me. So, because remember, they had not known about where I was for 3 months. That's a pretty long time. A story about that. My father was a minister. He had visited a couple little old ladies that were members of his congregation. And he got to leave. They had a little bit of prayer. And then they said, Pastor, would you like a cup of coffee? No coffee. How about a cup of tea? No tea. How about a glass of milk? No milk. And they looked at each other and said, how about a bourbon water? He said, no water.
That's a good one. I guess the last thing I'd like to ask you when you think about kids today who don't know a whole lot about World War II, you know quite a bit. You know what you went through. You saw others who didn't get to come home from the war. What is it that you hope is remembered about you and all the guys like you who fought and won that war?
I don't think any of us were heroes. We were survivors. We did what we had to do.
And what an inspiration for the rest of us. That is Carl Heuser, one of three XPOWs we got to hear from today. You'll find links to all their complete interviews at hometownheroesradio.com and more photos on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Next week, not a POW, but someone who would have become one or suffered a worse fate if he had not been rescued after floating for 4 hours in the water when his plane was shot down. I'll look forward to sharing his story with you. And perhaps every year when POW MIA Recognition Day rolls around in September, you'll think of men like Wild Bill and Julio and Carl and understand in an even deeper way that freedom is not free.